I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome back to the Lantern Rouge Cycling Podcast, presented by Zwift, here with Benji on our Monday afternoon for the La Vuelta Ciclista a España. It's exactly not how you should pronounce it. The recap of the entire race, starting in the Netherlands many moons ago, very soon after the Tour de France, and we finished in Madrid yesterday. So Evenepoel takes out the GC ahead of Mas and Ayuso, rounding out the podium. We will talk about how did Remco win the Vuelta, what next for Ineos, given what they've seen from their young riders here, and also Juan Ayuso. Should he go to the Tour? What next for him at UAE after a fantastic Vuelta, as well as did we like this parcours, the way it was designed? I think Benji and I might have some different views on that. So that's all to look forward to in this podcast. And as I said, GC, Evenepoel, first Grand Tour. He's already got the merch launched on Twitter. Life is a time trail. I think they got that fixed up. And yep, happy for him. And Quickstep points. Pedersen wins ahead of Wright and Mas. KOM, Carapaz wins ahead of Stannard and Mas because Vine crashed out. He looked likely to win. Evenepoel wins ahead of Ayuso and Almeida, the white jersey, and teams UAE comfortably by 55 minutes on Ineos, Movistar in third. And the stages were Jumbo-Visma TT, Bennett back-to-back sprints, Roglic the punchy finish, Soler the breakaway, Vine his first win from the GC group, then Harada sprint against Wright. Vine wins on Van Quire ahead of Remco, who took time on both those days. Then Menkes on Steep Prairies rest day. Evenepoel the TT, Groves his first Grand Tour sprint win. Then Carapaz became the Vuelta de Carapaz on Peñas Blancas, then Pedersen came in. These guys dominated the last couple of weeks. He won in the sprint to Montilla, then Carapaz on Pandera, Arensman on Nevada from the break, then Pedersen again, then Uran to the Monastery from the breakaway, Evenepoel won to Piornal ahead of Hesink, and then Pedersen, his third win in about 8 days on stage 19 before Carapaz from the break again, and then Milano, the lead out man of the century. So which stages had you forgotten, Benji? I will put my hand up and say that I completely forgot the team time trial because I don't know the impact it even had on the race. I don't think, only look, did it change anything in the top five?
Well, I don't think it changed that much, but it set an initial indicator, you know? It set an initial bonus for Jumbo versus the other GC competitors. So I guess there was that advantage, but that basically got negated a few days later in the bigger climbing stages. When it comes to stage that I forgot about, I'll be honest, I don't think this was the most memorable Grand Tour. I think the Soler stage in week one is probably one that won't stick in my mind for too much longer. That was indeed a rough watch. And, well, good for Soler that he wins that stage, first Vuelta stage after, I think, 2-3 years again, since the one he won last time, I'm pretty sure, that he was the one before again. So, anyway, like, that's the kind of stage that I will forget, those breakaway stages where limited stuff happens in the peloton. Those are the ones where I have difficulty following. But how about we start off with going through the Vuelta that we had and kind of figuring out how Remco Evenepoel went from the start of this Vuelta and ended up in the red jersey towards the end, because I don't think it went his way every single time. First of all, the team time trial, for example, it's a flat team time trial. Remco Evenepoel's team, Quickstep, losing 14 seconds on Jumbo-Visma in that time trial. Now, in hindsight, having seen the entire Grand Tour, that's nothing, but the day itself, that's a notable difference that Quickstep is losing towards Jumbo-Visma, that Evenepoel is losing towards Roglic, for example. I believe in the first, like, 3 days afterwards, those sprint stage in Utrecht and so forth, like, nobody was expecting stuff to happen in GC, I'm pretty sure. And stage four is really the day where potential other changes could occur. And that's where Roglic once again took an extra gap on Evenepoel by winning that stage. And not only that, 10 bonus seconds in total, because, well, wait a second. No, more, 13 seconds, because he also took that 3 bonus second sprint in front of Alaphilippe before in the stage. So that's extra seconds that Roglic was taking on Evenepoel. At this point in the race, do you think that it's normal based on the parkour of the first full stage that Evenepoel had taken a deficit towards Roglic?
I mean, 30 seconds is not inconsequential. And I do think this stage 4 was the worst stage from Quickstep of the race in terms of overall. They went for Alaphilippe is the answer. They went for Alaphilippe. He did not have the shape at this point in the race. And I continue to be of the view that when you're going for red and when you're going against red against Roglic, who you don't know his condition, so you have to assume the worst from a Quickstep perspective, which is that he's really, really good. And yeah, I think I said at the time, I didn't like the way they played it. But because he lost time and lost the bonus sprint, I didn't think, oh, Evenepoel's in bad shape, he can't win because he came 8th or 10th or whatever, because unlike the other GC riders, remember Movistar, they had Rojas, Oliveira dropping Mas off at the base, of course. I mean, yeah. Did well, Mas, but that all makes a difference. So we'll talk about Hayter at the back end of the show when we talk about the points jersey, but this was another stage where we're like, ooh, positioning's a problem. So no, I wasn't too concerned because I thought the TT would net off about 30 seconds and then the rest of the race would be equal. Like they'd be level, and I thought maybe Evenepoel had the edge. But the next stage was that Soler stage. Nothing really happened. I did think maybe Quickstep would try something. Stage yeah. 6 was the huge one. Picohano, we'd written this down, 12K, 6.5%. I thought it is hard to make differences on a climb like this. I really didn't expect such big differences. And I was wrong. The temperature went down to 15 degrees and Evenepoel put in a minute 20 into Sivakov, Roglic, Gegenhardt, Hindley, all the GC contenders except Mas on his wheel and Ayuso about 40 seconds back. This was like crazy performance, but I think it is worth remembering. You can't just be like, oh, great for Evenepoel. You have to think what played into his favor. Easy stage the day before. The temperature went down. The stage before was not that difficult. And yeah, I don't know. And maybe Roglic wasn't in top shape either. But yeah, what did you, like, is this the problem you have with the parkour, this stage being here? Because beforehand, we wouldn't have said, oh, the GC will be completely ruined by this stage.
No, I think I've got more overlapping, like, concerns when it comes to parkour. In general, I do enjoy this kind of stage being in week one. Initial, like, gaps being there, because that causes other riders that are already behind to be more aggressive in the second week, for example. That's what we might also see in the second week that we'll go through in a second. But, like, I've got more of an issue that it's always the same kind of climbs towards the end of stages. And I wanted like a stage where I'm like, oh, okay, this is the kind of crazy stage where I expect explosions to happen the entire stage. And when I looked at this Vuelta beforehand, there was no stage like that except for Sierra Nevada, perhaps. But Sierra Nevada is also not the climb that will have the huge explosions, for example. So that was my concern with the parkour, but we'll go into that a bit more in-depthly towards the end. But when it comes to Picohano, like, Evenepoel, great performance. We know that Roglic was not in top form after the Tour de France crash and so forth. But regardless of that, still a very high-level performance. And I'd argue he kept that up for the entirety of the first week, pretty much. I think that if we go towards the eighth stage, we saw him get to the line together with Mas and Roglic. So there he could not make the difference necessarily. But on the line, he was the first of the three, once again claiming territory, basically saying, yeah, guys, you can't even beat me in the sprint to the line here. And sure, it's not for bonus seconds, but he also didn't have to go all out sprinting against Roglic there, because Roglic kind of couldn't have that extra sprint towards the end of this stage. But I think the other big one next to Picohano is Les Prades. And it's one of those things where, I swear, back in the day, Basque Country still, we still had doubts when it comes to Remco and steeper climbs, where he seemed to drop off the back of those groups he was in Basque Country on the steeper climbs, and then gradually take his own tempo and crawl back to the front. But we knew at that time that his weight was higher than it was supposed to be at the Vuelta, because I think him or his coach had said that in the media. So I was expecting some better stuff in there, but the differences he made on the stage of Les Prades is significant. He finished on 1:34 of the winner, which is Mankies on that stage, and Mas finishes on 2:18. Ayuso sprinted past everyone with a 50 kilometer per hour sprint at the top of Les Prades. Like, that's also a big one, right? And that clashes the myth of steepness. But you already felt like that was okay after Elites in San Sebastian, right?
Yeah, I think I thought, oh, he's not going to do this performance on Pico Hano 6.5 for 30 and then not be able to do 6.7 or whatever he did. He did more than that, but let's say I thought the baseline GC guy would do 6.7 on Prares for 15 minutes. Well, he's not going to, like, his curve will somehow not be worse at 15 minutes than he could do at 30 minutes just because it was 13%, where it actually sometimes is easier to do higher watts on steep gradients. So I think this was extremely important, mainly because Mas was close. Mas was on 28 yeah. seconds before Prares. And I know Remco was always going to smoke him in the TT, but Mas, I think, in another world, which didn't exist, say there was the Pandera stage or, I don't know, the Pico Hano stage or something in the third week in hot conditions, then 28 seconds to Mas is not comfortable. And the reason this going into, so let's go to the TT then, because that's after the rest day. Evenepoel's got 2:41.303 on Mas. Why is this important? Well, first of all, for Roglic, not so much. Roglic was going to try and win. He doesn't matter about the parkour, didn't matter about UCI points, didn't care about the podium. So 2:41 versus 1 minute, it's just a better buffer to have. But it wouldn't mean that Roglic would mark Rodriguez and just ruin his chances at going for first. For Mas, with the points, they openly said, Movistar, that it's extremely important. And yep. we saw Quickstep were weak. After Alaphilippe crashed out, because Alaphilippe was good on Prairies, Quickstep were weak relative to what you might want in the third week on that sort of parkour. And it didn't matter because Rodriguez, Ayuso, Almeida, Lopez, Mas, because of this buffer, Evenepoel's on, O'Connor, they all just fired each other and paced each other back. And Remco pretty much didn't have to do anything except mark Mas on that 5% climb, and even if he drops there, like he loses 20 seconds, it doesn't matter at all. But yeah, I think that buffer was hugely important. And what do you think about people always say, oh, he's doing too much, not to Remco, I mean people who are very, very aggressive at the start of Grand Tours, and like, he'll pay for that at the end. I think that's flawed logic. Like, did Bernal do worse on Sega de Ala because he took lots of time on a 5 minute punchy effort to Campo Felice where he dropped Yates in week one? Like, I'd like to see the data on that.
I think it depends. I think there's some realism in the factor that if people spend more energy in the third week than in the first week, that they might have less energy in the last week in general. Like, I think there is some truth in that, but I also think that it doesn't need to be a bad thing all the time. Because, for example, when Pogacar was sprinting for no extra seconds, for no bonus seconds and so forth in the first week of the tour, I found that a bit too much sometimes. When it comes to Remco in this first week, he didn't do that necessarily. Try and massively sprint for a position and try and make sure he gains another 5 seconds in every sprint at the end of a stage. He didn't necessarily do that. He rode to the line. I think he did it once, perhaps, in week one somewhere. But when we look at this parkour of the Vuelta, it's also different towards other Grand Tours where the third week is not necessarily the most decisive week. So making that buffer initially is super important, and especially for a rider like Remco who might not be as confident about his third week than his first week, so wants to have that buffer beforehand. So I think for a rider like Remco in this Vuelta, it can add to the confidence of the rider, and it can add to the factor that the opposing competition, like you mentioned, like a Mas, gets into the situation where they start thinking about the podium more than the victory before the third week, and as a consequence, attack less in week two, and they might regret that in week three when they can't catch up with Remco anymore. That kind of stuff. I think It depends on the situation, case by case. But in this situation, I feel like it's very good that Remco took that time in the first week, spent a lot of energy in the first week to get that. But I also feel like he didn't go crazy. Like, I disagree with people that say he went crazy in week one and made sure that everybody knew that he was going for every single second. I think he was going strong. I think he was spending energy, but nothing insane either. And I think that brings us to somewhere in week two, Peñas Blancas now. Nothing really happened too increasingly there. Mas, Evenepoel, and Roglic finished together. And I think it's really the crash that occurred afterwards, right? I don't know if it was on the Montilla stage, a stage that Pedersen ended up winning ahead of Kokar and so forth. I think it was there where Remco Evenepoel had his crash. And that was a moment where we were like, okay, I don't know. It might have been actually on the stage before already, on Peñas Blancas itself, that stage before the final climb.
Yeah, it was.
But it became a factor for Pandera and Sierra Nevada, perhaps. His side was packed in. I don't know if the time he lost on Pandera and so forth is because of the crash. I have no clue. I don't have the data that Quickstep has on that and so forth. It's possible that he was just having a few bad days as well. But I'm guessing that the crash probably had an influence. But it's also not terrible, right? Losing a minute on your worst moment in a Grand Tour, because Roglic Formigal, for example, in that Vuelta, he still won the Vuelta, lost time on that day. I think every single Grand Tour winner has had one day probably in their Grand Tour where they lost time. Bernal Segadiala lost time, for example. Like, it's okay to have one bad day.
I think the crash was 100% the culprit. Roglic didn't even do like his peak level. It's not like Roglic just came in, recovered after the first rest day and was smashing everybody. Like, Arensman dropped Evenepoel, and no offense to Tim and Arensman, but that's, even if you think Evenepoel's dropped off 2%, well, then he's still going to be with Almeida and co. And Ayuso got unlucky on that stage too with the mechanical. So I think that was 100% the crash, but who cares? Like, that's his own damn fault. He crashed. It was a mistake. And crashes are the worst thing you can just about do for recovery or for winning a Grand Tour. Avoiding crashes like Pogacar does is extremely important. But before we get to the back end of the race, all the action was kind of front-loaded. It's September, and that means indoor season is here. Zwift have just announced a raft of updates with landing soon, so there's never been a better time to join or fire up the account. Again, if you pause your subscription over summer, there's more pace partners than ever, the ability to chase your PB ghost across segments, a new race series, and even new roads, all landing soon. Plus, with Zwift Academy starting soon, there's never been a better time to give indoor training a shot. For more information, head to Zwift.com down below. But yeah, Sierra Nevada, I think Evenepoel was fine, much better than Pandera. He was stronger than Roglic, Mas, and Lopez. I'm not sure if he was as strong as them. Maybe Mas was a little bit stronger than him because he was just playing the numbers game. He had like 3 minutes on Mas. He knew if he paces, he's also doesn't have any race. He has no experience of racing at that, going to that altitude. So he played it extremely conservative. He's just rode his numbers and was like, if I sit on this pace, Mas will gain minimal time. If I sit on this, Roglic can't do anything. He could have probably dropped Roglic on Hazelanas if he wanted to, I think, but he didn't. So that's the sometimes weakness, or you look at, you know, the results, you're like, oh, he lost time. It's like, that's not actually what happened. And when we get to the third week, there's not really too much to say other than he defended numerous attacks from Mas. If you have a 1 second advantage and all the climbs are 5%, then you have, like, I don't know exactly, pulling the number, say they're doing 30 kilometers an hour, you have like a 5-7% advantage. The other guy also has to get his team to pace. The other guy also has to then attack and spike, and you can be on the wheel, particularly when Mas, he's not like Pogacar or Roglic. Mas doesn't get separation from the group. He has to do a long attack. And yeah, that's basically the story of the third week, just defending. And there are actually no wobbles at all. And that's because of Roglic crashing out. Maybe if Roglic was there and Mas 1-2'd Evenepoel, could have been problems. I don't know. I don't think so either. So pretty comfortable, Benji. I disagree with the notion that it was a weak field, particularly for a Vuelta. It had the three-time back-to-back winner. It had, I think, 8 of the 10 of the Giro, including the winner, Jai Hindley. It didn't have Jonas and Pog, but rarely will the Vuelta have the 1 and 2 of the Tour in peak shape. So I think the start list was fine. And is there anything they would be thinking they need to do differently for next year, whatever Grand Tour he does?
As in Remco or?
Remco Evenepoel.
Remco Evenepoel. Okay, what should he do differently? Like, I think we spoke already about Remco Evenepoel and what Grand Tour he should do next year and so forth. That aspect of one of our previous podcasts, I think the Stage 20 podcast had that discussion in it for people that want to hear it. But adding on to that, I just say that it's not only Remco, it's also the team aspect. And for me, it's the decision on whether he's going to be sent to a Grand Tour with half a sprint train next to him with Jakobsen or Merlier. That might be more of the issue than Remco himself. I think Remco did pretty great. I think there were moments where he probably shouldn't have gone to the front of the group to start pacing, but it's not the end of the world because he's like 2.5 minutes ahead. So even if he gets countered, then it's fine. So I don't know. He played the third week really intelligently, defensive, as he probably should in the third week. Try not to get counted and so forth. I think in week 1 and 2, you need to try and use every opportunity you have to get the gaps. Like we spoke about Jumbo's 2020 Tour de France quite a few times on the channel before, where the first 2 weeks they played rather defensively on chances where they could have had more time with Roglic. And that was one of the things that backfired in week 3, for example, when Roglic had his Planche de Belfi, well, Pogacar had his Planche de Belfi moment, or they both had their Planche de Belfi moment, just the opposites of the extreme. Anyway, I think that's one aspect to it, but I think they did pretty strongly. I think it's almost flawless, this Vuelta for Evenepoel.
Yeah, I think he could do with Jan Hirt. I think Jan Hirt setting him up, doing a properly hard pull. Van Vilder was fine, but not great in the third week. He was not, like, a Sepp Kuss is a guy when the GC guys are attacking, when there's 8 GC guys left on that that climb Morcuera, for example, Kuss will be there, able to set pace just to keep it moving. And Van Vilder wasn't at that level, which is fine, but it is good to have someone like that. They will be hoping Jan Hirt can do that. I thought, well, Poles would have been a nice one, but they need someone to do that. Of course, Alaphilippe crashed out. I still think he can be a great domestique for Remco, but that's a difficult conversation to have, to be a domestique for an entirety of the Grand Tour if you're Alaphilippe. But yeah, that's Evenepoel. You know, can't really disagree with anything he's with the result he won, and maybe with the merch sales they can afford some more mountain domestiques. Who knows? Anyway, Ineos. Rodriguez ends up sliding down GC. He finishes in 7th, 1 second, it says 12 seconds off Arensman. He, Sivakov, had to leave the race with COVID. They both did incredible time trials in Elche. Like, couldn't believe how well they did on the flat. And at the same time, Carapaz sort of stole the show in the third week, 3 stages plus KOM, but he's leaving to EF. So the question is for them, Benji, do you, if you're Ineos, I mean, Rodriguez, obviously, he's like future GC leader. That's evident. I don't think him coming 7th versus 4th, like, doesn't matter relative to what I expect from him in the future. He just crashed badly. Sivakov is the question. Like, do you give him Giro leadership now with the Gagan Hart? Is he good enough for the Tour team? Like, how does the Vuelta change Ineos' plans with their GC squad?
I think there's a lot of questions and answers in this Vuelta, and perhaps some questions that we had before the Vuelta are answered, and some answers that we want are now, well, there's just new questions that popped up as well. And first of all, we also need to remind ourselves, next to Carapaz leaving, Bernal's trying to come back into GC mode. We have seen him be a domestique in Deutschland Tour, Denmark, and so forth. We don't know what it will give when it comes to GC next year. I'm considering him like a reserve for now in this discussion. I don't know what Bernal can do next year, so it's impossible to guess from my perspective. I think from your perspective as well, what he's going to offer in the GC squad of Ineos. I hope for Bernal and the team that he's able to rise up again and be the Bernal that he was before. But after an injury, you're never certain of that. We can just hope. But when it comes to the riders in this Vuelta, I think we can look at four riders here. Sivakov, Rodriguez, Hart, and also Plap. When it comes to Plap, I'll take him first, as in, I don't think he led up with the expectations that we perhaps put on him before the Vuelta. I also don't think that's that bad, because he's still super young. He's got plenty of opportunities next season to still show himself in that sense. He just also was put into a domestique role very early on in this Grand Tour, and as a consequence was losing time already, although I don't think his climbing was on point in week one anyway to have been in GC regardless of that role in the team. So he wasn't the GC prospect in this Vuelta. When it comes to the future, he can be, but he needs to show that in one-week races next year first, like he did in the UAE Tour, but also in like other ones next year. That's how I see that. Hope the team sees that he's got GC potential despite him not showing it in this Vuelta. Sivakov, he was not meant to be in this Vuelta, I'm pretty sure, until Burgos happened, and then he was suddenly co-leader of this Vuelta. So it's crazy how you can, so in a short term, go from not necessarily being in a Grand Tour to being the co-leader in that Grand Tour. And that, I think, shows how unsure Ineos was before this Vuelta of what their GC leaders in this Vuelta could offer. Now, I think Sivakov proved that he's a top 10 GC rider in this race and that he can fight for a top 5 in a Grand Tour. But that's a Vuelta and a Giro for me and not necessarily a Tour de France yet. That's how I see that, at least. His time trial was really good, though, as in, like, much above what I expected this time trial to be. I know he was decent at time trial, not great, but this was an amazing time trial for Sivakov, especially on one that is that flat, and that goes the same for Carlos Rodriguez. And I think Sivakov, I'm mainly thinking about if he wants to do GC leadership, then I'm mainly looking at other Grand Tours, not the Tour yet. I think Carlos Rodriguez has proven more for the Tour de France, but again, the parkour matters. Or do you think that we've had Rodriguez also do a great TT, by the way. Do you think that the parkour matters between those two, or do you think that they're similar enough in the climbs that they need?
Neither are good enough right now, I don't think, to contest for the TDF podium. Maybe that's unfair on Rodriguez, who's like, what is he, 21? So if he improves 0.05%, then he will be there. His TT, as you said, is good. His handling is good, generally speaking, too. If I was them, I would probably go Rodriguez in the Bernal 2018 role in the Tour. I thought he was ready for that this year as a domestique, get the experience, kind of try and backdoor a top 10 GC like anyway, but primarily as a domestique. I would go Sivakov, Gagan, Hart, Giro, and go Thomas, Tour de France leader again. Like, Thomas is their best chance on a normal TDF parkour at getting on the podium. And I would also try and convince Pidcock to be a co-leader and really go for GC. That Pidcock, I think, is above all of them in, obviously, potential. So I'd really just rinse and repeat, frankly. It's just there's no Carapaz, Benji, and there's no guarantee Bernal will be at Carapaz level, which was Giro favorite and came second. So I don't know. They got to be hoping one of, like, Rodriguez or Pidcock really step up fast next year, or they'll be going home again with no Grand Tour.
I think another aspect that we need to mention is we don't mention Adam Yates in this discussion. He has not confirmed to be at Ineos next year, and I feel like if I was Ineos, I would not extend him. He doesn't necessarily add too much when it comes to Grand Tour. Bases, are we wrong in that sense? Because if an Adam Yates is at this Vuelta, where do you see him land in GC?
Oh, it's impossible. That's it. Adam, no one knows. No one knows. I mean, he would have been with Remco on, or he would have dropped everyone and caught Carapaz on Sierra de la Pandera and then lost 10 minutes on Sierra Nevada the next day. It's impossible. Impossible, no. The likelihood is Simon Yates, I think, would have done better than Adam Yates, but he had to abandon with COVID. So I don't know. Yates look really good at Montreal. It's a one-day race. And there's no news with him either. Maybe the market's a lot softer for him than he would have hoped. And also maybe Ineos thinking Bernal's not ready to come back. I don't know. I don't really see the spot in the Tour de France squad for Yates. So it doesn't really make sense to re-sign him, in my opinion. There's also Danny Martinez, who we haven't mentioned at all.
Oh, yeah.
He struggled in Grand Tours. Well, no, that's not true. He came fifth in the Giro, but he's been better in 1 week. They'll also be hoping he progresses. So I would like to see them preference Martinez, Rodriguez, Pidcock, and G's already there. He just podiumed the Tour by 6 minutes. What about Ethan Hayter? We may as well do the points discussion. I picked him for points jersey here. I thought he'd average second and third across all these sort of the LaGuardia stage or whatever, but he's just struggled with the positioning, and then he have COVID or something. So should he just focus on trying to be a GC rider? Because his TT is already elite.
GC is, it's difficult, you know, because on one end, I would have expected him to do really well in that time trial that he just DNS'd just before the time trial started, which really sucks. Like, the timing of that COVID test was terrible for him. I think he would have podiumed that time trial. I still think so. Especially after we've seen Sivakov and Rodriguez both do well in that time trial, it kind of confirms to me that the Ineos setup is quite all right during that time trial, their skin suit and their new TT bike and so forth. Now, I agree with your positioning issue. We've said it so much before in this podcast that he's got the issue that he's at the back of the peloton so much, and then he needs to be able to get to the front in time for the sprint to happen, which sometimes has not worked this year. I don't know specifically during the Vuelta stage, to be honest, but I do remember that there were moments where he was trying to move to the front, and then in the last sector, he was kind of like pushed behind and he couldn't get past anymore, and that's how he was unable to compete for certain stages. But I don't know. I expected better from him on the kind of stage like La Guardia, where Roglic ended up winning on stage four. But again, positioning was the issue there. And I don't know, it's such a major issue that if he's able to fix it, like, he wins left and right, you know? Like, if he's able to fix that one issue, his bunch positioning, then he wins left and right, I think. But it's a real problem this year, and I don't know how easy it is to fix that issue, to be honest.
I think it is easier to try and turn Hayter into Roglic light, very light, than to turn Hayter into Mads Pedersen. The aggression, okay. Positioning, getting over, you know, climb. He obviously climbs very, very well for a sprinter, but he just does not contest the bunch sprints. And so there are about 1 centimeter different in height, according to PCS. There's about probably 4 to 5 kilos between them right now. But Thomas was heavier, and I think Thomas is about a little bit taller than Hayter, and he lost that track weight. If you look at him in TDU and his, you know, how he progressively lost the weight from being a classics rider. So I would just do the old school sky transformation, because it's a lot easier to position yourself at the end of a 10K, 6% climb that then kind of levels off. It's a soft finish, like the stage Evenepoel won again when he overtook Hesink. Say that's a soft finish, just it's a group of 10. It's a lot easier to position yourself against a group of guys averaging 62 kilos and you get a bit of a lead out from the front. Roglic has shown that for the last 4 years. And I'm not saying he's going to have the peak 20, 30, 40 minute power of Roglic. That's very, very unlikely. But in terms of World Tour 1 week races with a soft parkour, I'm not talking like Polonia. I'm talking like a really soft Paris-Nice, which has a lot of TTKs and some punchy finishes. I would try and convert him into that. And I think it's easier to hide the handling or whatever as a GC rider, not always, but as a sprinter, you cannot hide from it.
Yeah, I think so as well. Now, obviously, there's plenty of other future in Ineos as well, Magnus Sheffield, all those kind of riders, but weren't necessarily at this Vuelta. So I think we'll talk more about Ineos in our preview for next season, what that team that they have for next season will also be offering. So yeah, tune in for that somewhere towards the end of this year or at the start of next year, roughly. But I think that's about it for our Ineos discussion here at this Velta. I think we covered most of the points that we want to cover. But I also want to bring up UAE, a team that is here with two riders in the top 10. I don't know if they will both be equally happy about their positions. I'd argue they probably will, although the consequences of those positions might be more for the other than the one that got lower, for example. Juan Ayuso getting third in this Velta. Almeida getting fifth in this Velta. I would argue that if Roglic finishes this, then they're fourth and sixth. But again, Roglic crashed, so that is not the case. Third and fifth is a wonderful result for Ayuso mainly. That's like, it's insane, you know. This guy is 19. He's similarly built as Pogacar. He goes to his first Velta like Pogacar. Pogacar in his first year at UAE, he was doing the likes of, I think, California, where he had a pretty strong result. I don't know if he won our podium that race, but he built further. Algarve was really good for Pogacar that year. He built on that race by race and then did the Velta with, I think they called Aru leader, just like they did the year afterwards for the Tour de France. And in the shadow of Aru, that Vuelta, it was Pogacar building up and building up, and not necessarily in week one showing his hand, but slowly but surely being better and better, and overall winning three stages and finishing on the podium. Now, that's, I think, a year older than what Ayuso is right now. Ayuso did not win three stages. I don't think that the way the race played out was in favor of him winning stage in the first place, so I don't necessarily blame him too much for that aspect. Are you okay with that? Like, is it his fault?
No. It's not his fault. He's very, very fast. He, you see, winning sprint in La Guelia. He's been winning sprints all year. He's very, very fast. Very quite punchy too, but like, won the sprint. I know it wasn't against the best competition, but a Circuito de Getxo before. I think his flat sprint is actually maybe even better than his actual punch. But yeah, he should have won stage 20. If UAE, maybe they couldn't have, but if they went all in on Ayuso stage win, I believe he wins that stage, or has a very good chance of winning it. And I think he can win a lot of races next year. Now, he was sick around the time of the TT. That was a little bit below what I expected. So that could be the reason. I think Ayuso is all positive. It's all, he's the chosen one. I call him the chosen one, and he can win a lot of races with that punch. And the TT we expect to improve. Almeida is just much of the same, like slow start, sort of positioning is terrible. The descending, I'm not sure about, and just works his way into the race and gets progressively better and better and better, and ends up finishing fifth. So he literally, you look at his GC results throughout the race, he goes like 10, 8, 7, 6, 7, 6, 5. but I think when you have Ayuso and Pogacar, you're not trying to come fifth in Grand Tours. At least I don't think you should be trying to come fifth. You should be trying to win Grand Tours. And it's the Vuelta, so you're trying it out. And I'm not saying Almeida performed badly, but yeah, it's just tough for him with Ayuso and Pogacar. Like, I don't think the co-leadership really works either, to be honest. Like, I do think it would be better for Ayuso in terms of winning stages, bonus seconds, if you had Almeida 100% pacing for him all the time. It didn't matter here because Ayuso wasn't winning anyway, so it didn't matter. But I think what do you think? Do you think going forward, when they recalibrate in the off season, they slot him into a domestique role, or is it just Pogacar's TDF leader, Pogacar's leader of whatever race he does, and all the other races, it's still a free for all?
I'll be honest, I find it really difficult, because if Almeida does not have his COVID in the last 2 days of the Giro, last 3 days of the Giro, he stopped fiving two Grand Tours in 1 year, which is a really good result GC-wise. So he's a really strong GC leader that a lot of teams would want in their team. But his issue is that two other leaders in his team have performed better this year. Pogacar at the Tour and Ayuso at the Vuelta. There was none other guy at the Giro, so nobody could be better than him at the Giro. We don't know if that would have happened if he had another GC leader next to him. But overall, in three Grand Tours, he gets beaten by two better results by GC riders in his team. And I think from UAE standpoint, Ayuso and Pogacar have shown to be more talented. And Ayuso already in this short time span, which means that there's likely more growth coming for an Ayuso in a similar fashion that a Pogacar had after his Vuelta top three, for example. I expect Ayuso to grow more and indeed be a Grand Tour potential winner fighting for Grand Tour victories in the coming few years. Perhaps next year already, we don't know that. Depends on whether he grows from here on towards next year already. In that situation, when you're UAE, you start thinking about, okay, sorry Almeida, but you're on paper the third in the list of our GC leaders. And if we send Pogacar and Ayuso to the Tour and we also send you, then you're domestique. If we send Ayuso to the Vuelta or the Giro, then Almeida can start as a co-leader at that race. And in the first week, they can ride next to each other and then fold into a domestique role, the one that is doing worse in week two, in a similar fashion that we would expect other teams with duo leaders to do so in a Grand Tour. Because in a Giro Vuelta, I'd argue it's useful to have a secondary leader, especially in a time where COVID can take out GC leaders left and right. So I don't have that issue there. I still think he should be a Grand Tour leader in at least one Grand Tour as a co-leader to someone else. But I agree that Ayuso and Pogacar are the ones that can win Grand Tours, while Almeida has not proven that he can podium one yet. Although I still believe he can podium a Grand Tour 100%. I just think that he's been a bit unlucky at the Giro. I don't think he would have podiumed regardless of having done that time trial and actually finishing that Giro. He would have gotten fourth most likely. But it's only like a matter of a few seconds, eh? If Landa has a bit worse of a day and Almeida has a bit better of a day in that Giro and they both finish that Giro, then Almeida probably does better in that time trial and passes Landa in the time trial. That kind of stuff. So he's... Oh, it's so limited.
I think he can win the Giro. Because he has good TT, good punch, pretty good to altitude, is he? Or no, is that a weakness? I'm not sure. He's really good on steep gradients, blockhouse. I thought he was going to win that stage in the Giro. Maybe he would if it was the third week. His recovery and endurance throughout Grand Tours is excellent. And I think he has very quite fixable problems, actually. Yeah. And he wastes so much energy in stages where, and it's like you see him coming back and then he finishes 10 seconds behind, but the reality is like maybe he had the legs to gain time and you don't see the fact that he didn't gain time when he had the legs to do it if he played things differently. And what I'm talking about is on certain parkour, and I'm not a 10k 10% climb, the way Almeida paces is good,
yeah,
generally speaking. You just do your best, you set your power, you do your power. But on these Basque stages or on these irregular gradients, like a Pico Hano, where it's 7% for 4Ks, flat for 2Ks, 7% for 4Ks, or Sierra Nevada, where it's 11% for 4Ks, and then literally flat for 5 kilometers, and then goes up to 5%, I think his the way he paces is not always efficient. And also, it's not just that. It's on the tricky sort of stages, he really struggles for positioning. And whether that's awareness or handling, I'm not sure which one it is. If it's just awareness, and then maybe you can fix it a bit easier. So the Tour de France is going to be really tough for him because, like, the fighting for positioning is just... it's on another level to races like the Vuelta or the Giro usually. So still, I would think a hugely positive Vuelta for UAE with third, fifth, and a stage with Soler and teams. So they're going to be pretty pleased. Just quickly, Pedersen outperformed my expectations. I don't know why I glossed over him so much, but three stages is an excellent return. Trek put up a pretty funny tweet or video of him on the bus for the second one. Which is like really inspirational stuff, where he was basically telling them, the guys in the bus, I will win this stage if you deliver me. But the overall rating of the Vuelta, Benji, how would you rate it out of 10 and what would you change about it?
I'll be honest, it is not the Grand Tour I will remember for the rest of my life. Like, the one aspect that I will remember is the likes of Remco Evenepoel. As a Belgian, I will remember that he won the Vuelta here. As a cycling fan, I'll remember that he won the Vuelta here, the start of potentially a series of Grand Tours that he will compete for in the future, which is a very awesome thing. Like, I love seeing riders go from the youngsters that we see as talented, like Carlos Rodriguez back in the day, like an Iuso back in the day in the juniors, like Remco Evenepoel in the juniors, Kian Uytebroeks in the juniors. Those riders, I like following those careers from the start and then seeing them gradually improve and gradually get more results. Remco Evenepoel getting his Vuelta is probably the most memorable part of this Grand Tour, knowing that it might be the start of more when it comes to Grand Tour business. I can't wrap my head around the fact, I think Cycling Clown on Twitter posted this, that he needed to win a Grand Tour for people to that were like saying, oh, he's not a GC rider, to stop saying he's not a GC rider. He had to win a Grand Tour for that to change. It's crazy because with riders that come 15 Grand Tour already, like, okay, he's a GC rider. And for Remco, it took way more because he's got this polarizing audience. That's the memorable part, is him proving his haters wrong in this Vuelta for me. When it comes to the stage itself, I won't remember most of the stage. I won't be honest. I'll be honest, like, it's not the most memorable Grand Tour. I think one of the most memorable stages is probably because it was such a misery stage. The one where Roglic crashed, where Evenepoel had his puncture. That kind of stuff is memorable. What's your memorable stages here? Are there ones where you're like, oh, next year, will you rewatch that next year in the evening?
Pico Hano, yeah. That's crazy. As a Watts per kilo nerd, understanding what that performance was from both him and Vine, I'll remember that forever. That's just crazy performance. To put a minute 30, still just a minute 30 on that climb in the first week, the first mountain stage of a Grand Tour, just crazy. Doing performances we haven't seen in the on a pure Watts per kilo basis. Jonas on Altacam and Granat is better by when you factor in altitude, heat, difficulty of stage. But yeah. Pico Hano was very, very impressive. What I would change about the race, not too much, actually. I think the riders tried to make the best of it. What I would change is to have the stage 20 or stage, what was the soft one that Mass attacked a lot of times? I would just have one of the stages. No, it was stage 18, Piornal. One of those two's got to be way harder. And I don't mean frequency of climbs. I mean gradient of climbs. Piornal, if it was 13Ks, 8% descent, 13Ks, 8%, I would have been happy with the third week. Maybe Mass drops Remco. And then I would have made stage 20 just a little bit harder. I would have put a ramp pass. There surely must have been a ramp pass in the area somewhere to spice it up. That's what I would have changed. It was so soft that third week.
I think it's also in the details. I agree with you that it's like we've got these medium mountain stages like the stage 20. And it's not that I want the last climb to be steeper. I want like the second last or third last climb to be steeper. And I like those things being steeper because it's a launching pad for GC riders to move earlier in the stage. And we've seen that in last year's edition on stage 20, there were some steeper sections in those climbs that allowed for launching your riders. We see that in the last stage of Basque Country every single year now. That stage can have explosions because it has that really steep section in the middle of the stage already. And the climbs before are also notable enough to have multiple attacks. And it allows for satellite riders to be up the road and so forth. Those stages make Grand Tours for me, and I feel like those stages were the ones that were a bit too weak, but I think it's also because of the way the race went. I think, let's say Jumbo doesn't lose any riders, and let's say Quickstep doesn't lose any riders. Quickstep might still be strong enough to control, we don't know that, but Jumbo might have more opportunities to send riders ahead and benefit from that, that kind of stuff. Because teams were half decapitated towards the end of this Grand Tour, and knowing that they have less tactical stuff to do on these medium mountain stages. Do you think that played into how relatively easy Quickstep was able to control this last week?
I think that was just the drafting and the other top-gen GC guys just attacking each other, and that meant that Remco was able to follow in the draft when he needed to, or just set pace at the end of climbs, and yeah, it just was too soft. And I'll pick up what Benji mentioned about Basque Country, because if you look at the two profiles, the average gradients don't look too different. But for example, the third last climb on the last stage where Martinez won GC, 40Ks from the finish, it crests, is Krabbelin. That's very, very difficult. 4.1Ks, 10.5%, but there's like 500-meter section at 15%. It finished at 12% last 600 meters. Nasty climb. And the descents are technical as well. And then there's a short, medium mountain climb of no consequence really afterwards. But then the final climb to Arate, again, you're looking at it, 4.6Ks, 8.5%. That's still harder than what we have for any of the finishes here. This is the finish to Arate, but it's 3Ks at 10% in the middle of that. So these are where guys' legs, you can get separation and deny the draft benefit or put guys really over the limit who are trying to follow. Like Mas was so good on that stage before he crashed. So that's what we were missing in this third week. I don't think it made the race better having it so soft, actually. And I don't think many people will remember this third week at all for anything that happened except the Roglic crash, as you mentioned. But that was our Vuelta recap. Remco takes it out. Enric Mas, we've glossed over a little bit, and my apologies to him. I will say, to come from the Tour, COVID, saying he had a fear of descending, to come second, to take 140 or so extra points, 160 extra points from third in KOM, third in points, and four stage podiums, and he was unlucky not to win one, actually. Yeah, a lot of Movistar fans owe him some gratitude, I think, for virtually saving them. They have like a 1% chance of being relegated now, according to Raul's model in today's article. But that's all from us. I'm going back to Australia in a couple of days. I don't know where Benji's off to. Maybe there's like some public holidays in Belgium now after the Vuelta.
I'm going to the UK. Perfect time to go to the UK. Let's hope I'm able to get to the UK. I don't know.
Yeah, have they shut the channel down? I don't know what's going on. They shut the Tour of Britain down, which helped Movistar. Anyway, that's all from us. We'll have World Champs preview content rolling out very soon, so I'm sure you'll look forward to that, and we'll see you probably mid to late this week. Ciao.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.